and made sure that they are sanctioned as a terrorist organization. But even Arab countries, countries like Egypt and Jordan, indeed virtually every country except Iran and Syria, who is Iran's puppet state, are opposing Hamas. It doesn't do any good. One of the things that Hamas's attack has done, of course, is lead to civilian casualties. And I can't help but note that there is nothing Hamas wants more than civilian casualties. And for that reason, if that reason alone, I think it's clear that Israel is doing its best to avoid those casualties. Now, it's virtually impossible to avoid civilian casualties in wartime. Still, the record is, well, you could call it grim or you could call it optimistic. It's grim in that as many as 100 civilians, it appears, have been killed. But in a record where more than 400 Hamas terrorists, Hamas fighters, have been captured or killed themselves. So Israel has about an 80% kill ratio. I mean, on one side, I could say that's favorable compared to the United States. In the Iraq War, the lower estimates are that 80 to 90,000 civilians have died. Many estimates suggest it's in the hundreds of thousands, and indeed one estimate suggests it's more than a million. And I don't think anyone claims that four times that many terrorists have been killed. But whether you think that Israel is doing it for humanitarian reasons, or whether you think that Israel is doing it for the cold, calculating reason that avoiding civilian casualties allows Israel to pursue its self-defense against Hamas, I think there can be no doubt that Israel is trying its best to avoid civilian casualties. Hamas, of course, is making that as difficult as possible, sticking arms caches in mosques, hospitals, and schools. You don't have to take my word for it. You can take CNN's word or Human Rights Watch's word that Hamas is storing weapons in schools, hospitals, literally holding civilians physically in front of them when trying to avoid Israeli guns. Indeed, at the school that was hit just today, Hamas was shooting from the courtyard. Israel is using sophisticated satellites and pinpointing where the missiles go off, but it's very hard to get the rocket shooters in the few seconds they have between the time they know a rocket has been launched and before the Hamas terrorists scurry away. And a lot of times civilians are left dead. It is an awful, awful situation. And, of course, there are civilians killed in Israel with the Hamas rockets. There are also Arab civilians killed by Hamas, both those that are killed by Hamas rockets, as I reported before Israel's retaliatory strike began, as I reported back December 21st, two young girls in their homes were the target of a Hamas rocket that presumably was aimed at Israel, and more are being killed daily as Qassam rockets go awry. I'm sure there are some that would blame Israel for this, saying that if only Israel didn't attack Hamas, their rockets would be more accurate and would only kill Israeli civilians rather than Gaza civilians. In any case, I think we can all agree that civilians should be avoided. But how do you avoid civilians in wartime? How do you respond to an attack? Has there ever been a war in history where civilians have not been killed? I don't know of one. War is hell. And generally civilians are the worst targets. So what is the history of Gaza? How did this all come about? Why are we where we are today? And what is an answer? Is there any way out for the people of Gaza, for Israel, for the Palestinians in the West Bank, for the world, for Egypt, for Jordan? What is the answer? Well, I don't claim to have all the answers or even many of them, but I do think it is important to go through the history of Gaza so that we know where we are here. And I think in going through the history, the long history, I think we can get a better feel for what may be a way out of this situation. Gaza, of course, the city of Gaza, which is in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, is an ancient city. It's been around since antiquity. It was a Canaanite city. It was conquered by King David, in the first Jewish kingdom. It was then conquered by every manner of people, as it were. There were Romans, there were Persians, there was the reconquering and the second Jewish kingdom under the Maccabees, until the final destruction of the Jewish kingdoms by the Romans. Gaza, by the way, comes from Canaanite and Hebrew. Interestingly, it's not even an Arabic word. It comes from Hebrew, Gaza, meaning the strong one, because it was a stronghold, and it was so named. And Egypt has always played a major role in Gaza. Many of the times that Gaza was conquered, it was conquered by the Egyptians. In the 13th century, before the Common Era, B.C., as it were, it was conquered by the Philistines. The Philistines were a people from Greece, from the Aegean area. They were not Arabs. They were not Jews. They were not from the Middle East at all. They were from Greece. And the Philistines came and they conquered Gaza. And when the Romans took over from the Jews in around the time of Jesus, about 70 or 135 was when the last revolt was put down, the Romans decided to rename the entire area, which had been called Judea, or land of the Jews, and called it Palestina, or land of the Philistines. It was kind of a strange name, given that the Philistines had long been conquered. They were conquered by David, King David, in about 1,000 years before the Romans came, but they wanted to sort of wipe out Jewish influence. It's interesting that the whole word Palestine today is named for a Greek people, an Aegean people, that haven't lived in the area for some 3,000 years. Anyway, the city of Gaza remained. There were Jews remaining in Gaza even after Roman conquering. From about 250, there were Christians in Gaza too. There are ancient synagogues, actually, including one that dates back to about 500 that's been found in ancient Gaza. Of course, Islam arose in around the 7th century, and Muhammad conquered Gaza. And then about 150 years later, Egypt reconquered Gaza. And then the Crusaders conquered Gaza. This history of Gaza is very much the same as the history of Judea, the history of Palestine. The Crusaders conquered and lived there for another couple hundred years. And then you had the Mamluks conquer for about 200 years. And then the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, who ruled over all of Syria and southern Syria, Palestine, Jordan. Well, Jordan didn't exist. Judea, all of those lands, including Gaza, from about 1517 on through about 1800. In fact, in 1799, Napoleon invaded the city. You get the point, I think. The Gaza has been frequently invaded by many, many different peoples. But starting about the early 1800s, Gaza was mostly dominated by Egypt. The great Muhammad Ali made Gaza a part of Egypt. Not the boxer, but the ruler of Egypt in 1832 made Gaza a part of Egypt for about 50 years. It was recaptured by Turkey for another 50 years or so. And then, of course, came World War I and the British Mandate of Palestine. The British conquered, fought Turkey in World War I. They conquered all of the Middle Eastern areas owned by Turkey. That includes places like Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, what is today Israel and Jordan, the West Bank and Gaza. And indeed, British took over Egypt as well. You can read about some of those things in Lawrence of Arabia. And then the British decided to split up the territories. Egypt was relatively independent for a while. It had some British influence, but it was always sort of an independent government. Syria and Lebanon were given it to the French. Iraq was split off, and Saudi Arabia from Palestine. I don't want to give the whole history because I'm trying to focus on Gaza. But basically, the British Mandate of Palestine was set aside for the Jews. That would include lands that today include Israel, West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and Jordan. But soon after, it was divided, split along the Jordan River. Transjordan became closed to Jewish settlement. That was for an Arab state. And Palestine would become a Jewish state. Indeed, under international law, the League of Nations gave Palestine to Britain under the condition that it find a Jewish homeland there. Meanwhile, Jews and Arabs were living there relatively peacefully. It was a fairly empty territory. If you read Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad, you know that in the late 19th century, there were relatively few people in all of Palestine. Then came the Zionist movement, the return of Jews to their Holy Land, both because of persecution abroad, probably largely because of persecution abroad, but also because that was the homeland for Jews. That was where they came from. Europeans were saying, Jews, get out of our country, and they can only go back to their land, to Judea. So, back to Gaza. There were Jews in Gaza from antiquity until about 1929. There was always a Jewish presence in the city of Gaza, which really is the only part of Gaza that existed. The land was there, obviously, but mostly Bedouins were traveling through. The only settled part of the Gaza Strip was the city of Gaza. By the way, there's a great Talmud scholar named Nathan of Gaza who lived there in the 1600s. Anyway, Jews lived there with Arabs. Of course, it was majority Arab. Well up until about 1929. In 1929, there were riots throughout Palestine. They began at the Western Wall in Jerusalem, with the Arabs insisting that the Jews not set up prayer there, and went through the entire region with riots and mass murders and horrific violence of Arabs attacking Jews. It was pretty one-sided. In fact, I've done a lot of history work for Today, and I've even read the British Mandatory Report from that time, just because I was curious sort of who started it. It's kind of hard to tell, but there is a long report from the Commission of Inquiry led by Sir Walter Shaw, who points out, and this is a direct quote from the Royal Commission, the outbreak in Jerusalem on the 23rd of August was from the beginning an attack by Arabs on Jews, for which no excuse in the form of earlier murders by Jews has been established. The outbreak was not premeditated. The disturbances took the form, in the most part, of a vicious attack by Arabs on Jews, accompanied by wanton destruction of Jewish property. A general massacre of the Jewish community at Hebron was narrowly averted, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so there were the great riots of 1929, and in fact, the entire Jewish community of Gaza fled the region. Understanding, of course, it was a majority Arab city. In the 1930s, they returned just a few years later and established a kibbutz, Kfar Darom. Actually, it was a fruit orchard to begin with. The Jews were again kicked out or massacred or forced to leave in the 1936 to 39 revolts. The Kfar Darom was reestablished in 46. So here you have, just before the partition of Palestine, you have a Jewish community in Kfar Darom, at least, that's living there. Now, of course, there was the partition plan of 1947, where the both sides wanted a state, and the British decided to throw up their hands and allow the United Nations to decide. And so the United Nations split it up, and in that split, they gave what would later be the Gaza Strip to a new Arab state, whereas other areas were given to a Jewish state. And we all know what happened then. The State of Israel was formed, tried to live in its peace with its neighbors, but the day after its declaration of independence, Israel was invaded by some five armies. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the Egyptians were to invade through the Gaza Strip. It was the natural point of invasion for the Egyptian army into Israel. And interestingly, they got stopped right there at that kibbutz in Gaza, Kfar Darom, where they were held up for several days. They were also stopped by another kibbutz called Yad Mordechai, filled with survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto, the people who survived the Nazis, in many ways stopped the Egyptian advance. The kibbutz Kfar Darom was forced to flee. Egypt came in, conquered the Gaza Strip. Israel conquered the rest of the territory, excepting the West Bank, of course, that was decided for the Arab state. But basically, most of those areas probably 70% of them were conquered either by Egypt or Jordan. Now, Jordan took over the West Bank, went into East Jerusalem, forced all the Jews there to flee, including, you know, the ancient Jewish community in Jerusalem. And meanwhile, Arabs living in areas where Israel came in, they fled as well. And many of them fled to the Gaza Strip. One of the interesting things about the Gaza Strip is that it's so much more of a refugee camp and a terrible place to be compared to, for example, the West Bank. Some 40% of all its inhabitants live in refugee camps. Only 10% of the West Bank inhabitants live in refugee camps. And Egypt ruled Gaza with an iron fist. Unlike Jordan, which annexed the West Bank, made it part of Jordan, and allowed the Arabs there to have full Jordanian citizenship, Egypt did not. Egypt would not allow anyone to leave Gaza. The people of Gaza were stateless. And Egypt, as I said, had them in refugee camps. Also, Egypt was in charge of all civil and military functions at that time. So there was no civil service. There was no middle class developed in Gaza. Gaza was one teeming refugee camp, if you will, where 40% of its members were, I got my figures right, 40% today live in refugee camps. I don't know how many live in refugee camps under Egyptian rule. It was probably much higher. The point is that Gaza has never, ever had an easy time of it, and they certainly didn't under Egyptian rule. It's interesting, I was reading that in the 1948 war, in 49, Israel actually conquered Gaza in fighting back in its battles against Egypt, and yet gave it back to Egypt because Israel did not want control over Gaza. Apparently, Egypt did neither. But Egypt did rule over it, and basically with the same iron fist that Egypt rules over the rest of Egypt. Then came, of course, there's the 56 war, the 67 war, the 73 Yom Kippur war, all wars begun by the Arabs trying to exterminate the Jewish state. They all failed, and Israel conquered in 56 and 67 Gaza. In 56 as in 49, Israel gave back Gaza. In fact, it's interesting, that would be the second time in 56 that Israel conquered Gaza and gave it back. In 67, they kept the area. And it's also interesting to compare how Gaza was from about 1967 to 1987. It was a relatively peaceful time, probably the best time in Gaza's history. More than 25,000 people in Gaza worked in Israel and earned a livelihood that way. Israel built, in 1978, the first university ever in Gaza. The Islamic University of Gaza was built under Israeli occupation in 1978. It still, let's be clear, was not a very nice area to live. I remember when I visited Israel in, would have been 1989, and was invited to go to Gaza, and I declined, thinking it was unsafe even then. But still, people live there. Israel reestablished that old kibbutz that had been there in the 30s, in 1970, in Kfar Darom, and while I can't say that people were completely loving of each other, at least there was relatively little violence. At least there was, of course, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. There were terrorist attacks, but most of them were in the forms of doing things like, entering a school and shooting 8 children, things like that, rather than the kind of suicide bombings and missiles which we're used to today. The first intifada began in Gaza in 1987, apparently an Israeli truck accidentally killed 4 Arabs. And it was a civilian truck, and I'm certain that driver should be punished for negligent homicide. But what happened next, I think, surprised everyone. Everyone from the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Yasser Arafat to certainly the Israeli authorities when there was a spontaneous uprising. Indeed, that intifada means is uprising. And the intifada began. People protested against Israeli rule. In those days, it was mostly done with stones. And the response was usually with tear gas. Wow, almost seems like an innocent time compared to the current time. But from That came the Oslo Accords. In 1993, Israel signed the Oslo Accords with the Palestinian Authority, which it recognized, run at that time by Yasser Arafat. The Oslo Accords gave Israel control over Gaza's airspace and sea space, but gave the Palestinians control over the 80% of the territory in which there were not Jewish settlements. At that time, still, there was Israel got 15% of its agricultural exports from Gaza. So even though it's a very crowded area, there is plenty of land enough that they have agricultural exports. In fact, 70% of Israel's organic produce was from Gaza. There was the population, the Arab population kept growing, and there were Jewish settlements there, including some 38 synagogues. The Oslo Accords were designed to come to a Palestinian state, and I think we all know what happened next. Various pieces of territory were given up in the West Bank and Gaza, piece by piece by piece, until the great Camp David Accords of 2000, when Israel promised to give more than 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza back to the Palestinians to form a Palestinian state. Yasser Arafat, to his always shame, I think, refused that deal. And in doing so, truly harmed the people of the West Bank and Gaza, I think, more than almost anyone. And refusing that deal, what a deal it was. So then, after refusing that deal, the Yasser Arafat began a second intifada. But this time, after the Oslo Accords had allowed the PLO back in, had allowed Fatah fighters, the former Palestinian Liberation Organization, to come in, tens of thousands of them with guns, and now things were dangerous. Now, instead of a fight over stones and tear gas, a fight where relatively few people were killed on either side, a fight where negotiations would have led to the creation of a new Palestinian state, finally in 2000, after all these years, now they had guns. And now there were suicide bombs. And now the attacks were really dangerous. Sometimes people forget history. Forget that just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, prior to the Oslo Accords, prior to Israel sitting down with Yasser Arafat, inviting him and his fighters back, they were in Tunis. They were all the way in Tunisia, inviting those tens of thousands back with their guns, with their weapons, supposedly to be a police force. Whatever troubles the people of Gaza or West Bank had, they were fought over with rocks and with tear gas. I'm not saying life was good for them, but it was better for the people of Gaza than, well, better than the Arabs living in Egypt, who also live in grinding poverty. They did have a university, but times were not good. Let's face it. They were just about to get a lot worse. So then what happens? Then we have second intifada. We have more fights between Israel and the Palestinians. We have a rash of suicide bombings. We have people from Gaza and the West Bank, terrorists coming in and blowing up theaters and synagogues and houses and killing hundreds and hundreds of Israeli civilians. Israel finally builds a big wall, and the attacks stop. Largely. There have, in fact, have been very few suicide bombers in Israel in the last 2-3 years. The security wall has worked, at least from the Israeli point of view. Arabs complain about the fact that it might separate some farmers from their gardens. And, in fact, it does. There's no question it does. But in terms of loss of life or stopping terrorist attacks, it worked. So then comes the Bush administration, right? And they are going to practice benign neglect. They're not going to get involved in too much negotiation. And Ariel Sharon, someone who'd been decried as a terrorist himself by many on the left, someone who is responsible in large part for allowing the massacres at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon to occur. He was condemned for that by an Israeli commission. Not that he caused the massacres, but he did allow Maronite Christians to occupy a Palestinian refugee camp, and the commission found that Sharon should have known that because of all the mistreatment of Christians in Lebanon under Muslim rule, that the Maronite Christians would seek revenge against the Palestinians, since the Palestinians had killed the Christians earlier, and there was a massacre at Sabra and Shatila, and Sharon was held responsible. I think Sharon, in many ways, changed the view of history before he suffered a deadly stroke, in saying that he was changing his mind. He was not going to be the far-right Likudist who wanted to keep the West Bank and Gaza and Israel forever. He would support returning the lands, and even if he had no one to negotiate with, even if Yasser Arafat and his successors refused to negotiate, refused to take yes for an answer, Sharon decided to unilaterally disengage from Gaza. He said, it doesn't matter whether we have anyone to negotiate with or not, we're going to leave. And then we will see whether or not the people of Gaza can rule themselves. When we come back, I'm going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the decision to leave Gaza, Israel's decision to leave Gaza, what people said at the time. I've been doing a lot of research. And also what I said at the time, because I supported the move at the time, and I'm wondering now if it was a mistake. Let's take a quick break, and we'll get back to that history right after the break.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Bush, who no doubt gave Israel the nod to go into Gaza, has been blasé about the brutality, even as the Palestinian death toll vaulted to almost 600 and the number of wounded approached 3,000. Of course we'd like to see, you know, violence stop, he said casually. And then he added condescendingly, I know people are saying let's have a ceasefire, and those are noble ambitions, but any ceasefire, he said, must have the conditions in it so that Hamas doesn't use Gaza as a place from which to launch rockets. Well, that's the Israeli line, even though only a handful of Israelis had been killed by these rockets. This isn't an eye for an eye, it's 1,000 Palestinian eyes for an Israeli eye and a full set of Palestinian teeth for one Israeli tooth. In the last couple of days, Israel's bombed 2 UN-run schools and a central market in Gaza, along with an apartment house with children playing on the roof. Children. Israel has killed more than 150 Palestinian children over the last 10 days, with Bush's blessing and full U.S. military support. It makes me ill, and it's got to stop. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
from Washington. More of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm discussing the history of Gaza because I do think it's important that we know where we stand. And so many people, I think, either they say, well, Hamas attacked Israel. Israel has the right of self-defense, and they start there. Or they move back. They say, well, Israel was putting Gaza under siege, and they don't talk about what happened before then, which was, of course, Israel's unilateral disengagement from Gaza. And so I just think it's important to give the entire history in place. I know I've got Preston from Denver on the line, and I'll get to him in just one second. I do want to talk briefly about the unilateral disengagement from Gaza, because I remember very much discussing it with a friend of mine. I supported that disengagement. In fact, if you look through the archives on my website at RadioInsideScoop.com, you will see I was a big fan of it. I wasn't the only one. The United States government supported it. The Europeans supported it. The Arab governments welcomed it. The Palestinian Authority welcomed it as well. It seemed the one thing everyone could agree on was that Israel should get out of Gaza as soon as possible. That is, everyone in the world. In Israel, public opinion was split. About 60% supported the disengagement. About 40% did not. My friend was, she thought about the 40%. And she said, look, you know that if the Palestinians take Gaza, they're just going to use it to form a terrorist base to attack Israel. And they're just going to use it to attack innocent Israeli civilians. And when they do that, and Israel has to go in and reoccupy Gaza, the entire world will complain and talk about how awful Israel is. And I said to her at that time, and I remember this conversation clear as day, I said, look, Israel's got to give the Palestinians a chance. Israel's got to allow them to rule themselves. Israel's got to use Gaza as a test to see whether or not the Arabs can live in peace, the Palestinian Arabs can live in peace with Israel. This is a test. And if Gaza passes the test and can live in peace with its neighbors, then Israel can withdraw from the West Bank as well. But Gaza is relatively small and relatively isolated, unlike the West Bank, which, you know, is 9 miles from Tel Aviv and is seconds away from Jerusalem. Jerusalem, in fact, borders the West Bank. I said, this will be a great test. And if they don't succeed in being peaceful, if they attack Israel, then when Israel reoccupies the territory, at least the world will understand why Israel's doing it. Interestingly and sadly, I don't know whether my friend was right or I was wrong or what, but Israel is reoccupying Gaza now, probably not to keep, probably just to try to limit the Hamas missiles. And the Europeans, the Americans, the Arab governments, even Egypt and Jordan seem to recognize that Israel has to do this dirty work, that they have to respond in self-defense. And yet at the same time, all of us have to grieve for the civilian losses. All of us have to grieve and say to ourselves, what do you do when a terrorist group takes civilians hostages, shoots missiles from a hospital or a school site? Do you respond or don't you respond? And if you don't respond, doesn't that encourage the terrorists to put more missiles in schools, mosques, and hospitals? How do you fight people who want civilians to die? Remember, Hamas killed 616 civilians, Arab civilians, over the last 2 years in its fight with Fatah because it wanted to take over the territory. And now we have another 100 civilians dead. And one thing, though, I do think it's important to make clear is to distinguish between the fighters and the civilians. When people say 500 or Matt Rothschild just says 600 dead, we know of 100 civilians that are dead and at least 400 militants. So please, let's not put the murderers in with the innocent. Now let me go to Preston, who's been holding for a while. Preston, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi. Well, what do you do? I think there are a few things we can do. I think we need to keep in mind the notion of state terror. Peter Ustinov made a remark about how terrorism is the war of the poor and war is the terrorism of the rich. And, you know, it's not so much about Israel being awful. It's about how the U.S. military empire has used Israel as a proxy against Arab people. And certainly Arabs do have it very bad in Egypt as well, because we've been supporting their dictator for so long. Similarly, we've been supporting a dictator in Saudi Arabia, and we implanted a dictator in Iran. In Israel, we're supporting a militarist regime that's committing human rights abuses, and I think Matt Rothschild was exactly right. It's sickening, and it has to stop, and we can stop it. Israel would not be doing this without the approval, without the authorization from the U.S.
I don't know whether that's true or not, Preston. I do think Israel will take actions in its self-defense sometimes, whether or not the U.S. gives a wink and a nod. But let me ask you this. What do you think, if you were advising the government of Israel, how do you think it should respond? It's had about 1,000 missiles strike its territory over the last year. What do you think Israel should do? Should it simply just accept the fact that 5 or 10 or 20 of its citizens are going to be killed every few months by missiles from a foreign territory, or should it try to stop the missiles? And if it should try to stop the missiles, how would you suggest it do that?
I think it should try looking itself in the mirror and recognize that those missiles coming across are blowback from the missiles they've been sending from the F-16s and the Apache helicopters and from the drones and from the daily violence of a military.
Well, you called it blowback, but of course you know Israel entirely disengaged from Gaza, left every inch of territory, even the Philadelphia route, which is a little strip between Gaza and Egypt, which Israel had a right to keep under the Oslo Accords. It even gave up that in the hopes that Gaza would be peaceful in 1990. So it didn't occupy an inch of Gazan territory, and still it got the missiles after it. So what should it do? Should it simply accept the fact that its citizens are going to be killed and say, well, this is, you know, we can afford to have 1,000 missiles hit our cities? If not, how should it respond? It tried sanctions, and those didn't really work well enough. What do you think it should do?
Well, it didn't completely disengage. They disengaged to the point where they were no longer responsible at all for the land and the people they were occupying. So they pulled out, but they were still... Bombs come in from them, and there's still the...
No, there weren't. No, wait. I don't know where you say that. There were no Israeli bombs going into Gaza until Gaza hit Israel. In fact, until Hamas took over Gaza,
regular
there was...
feature. You didn't make it to the Gaza Strip, but a lot of people have. And F-16s and the Apache attacks are a regular feature of life in the Strip. Again,
they're a regular
feature. I don't think you're wanting to
since the
look
missiles.
At this. You're
came.
Seeing the missiles coming, but you're not seeing the missiles being sent. The ones that we're making, homemade in the truest sense, made here in the U.S. A friend of mine who went to the Gaza Strip was trailed by a child there who had picked up shrapnel and put it in a empty milk container and was shaking them and following her, saying, "Made in America, made in America." I think it's also important to keep in mind how many people were killed in this conflict before, you know,
But basically what you're saying, it's very interesting to me, because what you're saying, in effect, is that Israel, unique among nations, should not defend itself, right? I can't think of any nation in history that has taken 1,000 missile attacks that hasn't defended itself.
What you're saying is
strange, because when Israel leaves the territory and says, all we want is peace, and they're attacked, you seem to feel like they shouldn't fight back at all.
I'm not saying they should defend themselves. I'm saying they shouldn't be an aggressor.
How should they defend themselves? That's my question.
They shouldn't put settlements. You know,
but they withdrew the
settlements. Such a threat. Why do you put settlements in their
land? They withdrew the settlements, every last one of them.
Why do you pull those orchards?
Look, they left the settlements. There were 38 synagogues. The Palestinians burned the synagogues.
Why do you see the
farmland? Here's the thing. How do you put the situation right? I guess that's my question.
Do you see a military occupation as an act of war and a siege as an act of war or not?
Okay, but there was no occupation and there was no siege.
You know, there's like denial, you know, kind of a Holocaust denial of sorts going on. You know, I would say
you were talking past each other. I find it really sad. I do. Because when you start to deny history, you can't come to any possible solutions. I agree. It's a terrible situation. But when Israel unilaterally disengaged from Gaza, they left every square inch that was certified by the United Nations.
You know, speaking of the UN, it's interesting how the UN regularly, year after year, votes like 180-3 against Israel's position, against their aggression. I mean, is the whole world just wrong in the U.S. and Israel?
Well, right now,
the world believes Israel's right. With them.
I mean, right now, the United States, the European Union, the head of the European Union felt it was justified. Egypt thinks it's justified. Jordan thinks it's justified. Even Palestinians in the West Bank, Abu Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, was calling on Hamas to stop the rockets. Would you call on Hamas to stop the rockets?
Certainly. But I'd also listen to what General Shlomo Gazit said, former chief of intelligence for the Israeli military. Nobody can reject or condemn the revolt of a people that has been suffering under military occupation for 45 years against occupation force.
But they weren't occupied. See, here's the thing. When people say they want Israel to end its occupation. But when Israel ends its occupation and the people still attack Israel, they're condemned. If Israel were to leave all of Gaza and all the West Bank tomorrow, is there any doubt in your mind that Hamas would continue to shoot missiles and try to kill as many Israelis as possible until all of Israel was free of Jews?
Some faction will shoot as long as Israel try to create like a Warsaw ghetto, which they
No, but wait a minute. Is there any doubt in your mind that as long as a single Jew exists in the Middle East, Hamas will try to kill that Jew?
You know, Arabs and Jews have been living peacefully, and they still do actually to this day, for eons. I'm sure that can happen again when...
Well, it does happen. It happens throughout the state of Israel. It's even happening largely in the West Bank these days.
Yeah. See, but the military empire wants factionalized groups, Jews, Arabs, liberals and conservatives, you know, communists.
Preston, here's what I'm trying to understand here, and I really fear we're talking past each other. What I'm trying to understand is this. If you're saying Israeli occupation should not continue, then I assume you think the unilateral disengagement from Gaza was a good idea.
Well,
and if you think that was a good idea,
circumstance of that disengagement. Again, it wasn't like Gazans were left alone. They weren't.
Well, they were.
There was a siege.
Israel. I don't know if you remember what happened there. There was an airport. There was a that was going to be rebuilt by Israel. There was a seaport that was funded by the Netherlands and France. There were tens of billions of dollars in aid that were coming in. In 2005, it was seen as a positive time. Then, of course, what happened next was there was an election. And Hamas won a plurality of the vote. They got 43%. Fatah
because
got 40%, and Fatah
there.
Was very corrupt. And with that plurality, they got 56% of the seats in the parliament. And then, of course, a year later, Hamas set up the Palestinian civil war and killed some 616 Arabs, which is horrible that it would kill all those people. And now it runs a totalitarian state. But I feel for the people of Gaza. Wouldn't the people of Gaza be better off if we could somehow get rid of Hamas?
Well, they voted for Hamas because of the social work they're doing. This often gets overlooked when they're
you're right about that.
A terrorist network. Okay. And as far as Hamas setting up the civil war, again, I think we need to look at the history of U.S. creating civil wars. In places like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua.
Wait. You're not blaming the United States for the Fatah-Hamas civil war, are you?
I think the U.S. and its CIA agents have a long history of stirring up trouble between groups that they do not want unified. Whenever some Arab leader, you know, talks about Arab nationalism or Pan-African unity, you know, that's when our power elite gets very concerned and very active. And Mossad agents, they've got infiltrators and they've got collaborators. In fact, I won't be surprised if there aren't some Israeli collaborators sending off some of these missiles to provide the pretext for this state terror. Again, that makes a lot of
sense. Wow, that would be quite an allegation, quite a charge. I actually think it's the opposite. I think that Hamas is killing civilians because Hamas wants civilians dead. Every civilian dead is a victory for Hamas. Hamas's goal is to show as many bloody civilians as possible so that the world will force Israel to stop Hamas from getting more and more sophisticated weapons. I mean, remember, Hamas used to have missiles that could shoot 20 miles, and then they had a truce and they could shoot now 40 miles and some say even 60 miles. And, I mean, Hamas's goal is to conquer Israel. And
they'll probably get more
dead civilians missiles, help it, you know, in that goal, which is one reason why I think Israel is avoiding civilians as much as possible.
They'll, you know, and Hamas and others will probably get, you know, missiles that can go further and cause more damage. I mean, this is the policy.
It's only going to get worse and worse.
Wrong direction. Right. And that's,
but that's why I
want
to talk about in my last 10 minutes. I want to talk about a solution. Let me go to another caller who's been hanging on the line, if I could. Thank you for your call, Preston. Let me go to Jeff in Shreveport. Jeff, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark. Long time no speak.
It has been a while.
Yes, it has.
I think you only call in when you disagree with me. You never call in when you agree. But go ahead, Jeff.
Well, actually, the last caller made a point. You said Hamas's goal is to defeat Israel.
Right.
And that's, I suppose, a bad thing. Israel's goal is to defeat Hamas. Is that a bad
thing? No, Israel's goal is to exist.
No. Israel is right now in the process of trying to defeat Hamas, correct?
Right, because Hamas wants to destroy Israel's existence. But Israel didn't used to feel this way toward Hamas. Before Hamas began armed attacks against Israeli citizens, there were even Hamas mayors in the 70s of various West Bank cities. It was seen as the Islamic alternative to the PLO.
But
Israel's goal has always been to exist. That is their goal. That is their sole goal, to exist in peace.
But Israel's goal is unfortunately not live and let live. You know, it's like
it has always been that.
No. The Palestinians are under their thumb.
And which Palestinians? In Gaza?
Well, yes. Period. I mean, I've seen this since I was a child, and it's like we Americans will see this uneven war, and it is a war. I want to ask you a question real quick.
Yeah.
Do you think that in this engagement right now that I'm going to call them soldiers, because we don't want to call these guys what they are, because they are the government. Hamas is the government. And do you think they have a right to shoot at the invaders?
The invader? They do not have a right to invade a sovereign nation. No.
Well, I'm talking about Israel as the invader. See,
well, why are you talking
Hamas,
about Israel as the
Hamas
invader?
I
mean, Poland may have struck back at Nazi Germany and invaded a tiny bit of German territory. I don't know if they did when the Nazi Blitzkrieg or, the United States invaded Japan after Pearl Harbor. But I don't consider a victim's invasion, I mean, that's a response to aggression.
But see, you're not catching my point. And this is
no, I mean, when we invaded Afghanistan, does that justify Al Qaeda's attacks against the United States?
Well, actually, I would say, well, you're asking the wrong question. I think that everyone who shot at an American soldier in Afghanistan, you know, as an Afghan, troop or whatever, they had a duty to. We were invading their nation.
But many Afghanis
opposed
the Taliban,
this notion,
and were glad to be free from their rule.
I'm sorry?
Just like I think many Palestinians oppose Hamas.
Well, I mean, you might root for America. You know, I root for America all the time. You know, but the notion that we can go anywhere we want and bomb people and they shouldn't shoot back is utter arrogance.
Well, Jeff, I see a huge distinction, and you know I've talked about it on the air. I see a huge distinction between Iraq and Afghanistan. I opposed Iraq from day one. Iraq didn't attack us. It was wrong. It was no question about it. It was against international law. I've always felt differently about Afghanistan. We were attacked. 3,000 Americans were murdered by Al-Qaeda, which was funded and sponsored by the Taliban. We went back into Afghanistan, and even though there's lots of problems in Afghanistan, I think that largely we've done a good thing, and
most of
the Afghani populace is glad we're there. Now there's huge mistakes that Bush has made, and I think Obama can do a lot better job.
No, Mark, we've been, it's just like in Gaza and everything, we're being paternalistic. Okay, if France had done 9/11, we would have given France the finger, bombed them, and gone home. You know, but we're paternalistic with Afghanistan. You savages, we're going to civilize you. And we've been bombing them for 7 years now. We just bomb, made their place into more of a hell. You know, and we see, when we go, we're doing you a favor. And what's happening in Gaza right now? You know, I shouldn't say we, I'm not Israeli, but the West, I guess you could say, is invading, you know, to me, it's a sovereign territory. They have a government.
The sad thing is that and, if they had a functioning government, Israel would have had no need to invade.
No,
if they had a government that simply didn't attack Israel and lived in peace and would accept all the offers of aid from everyone around the world and Europe and the airport Israel was building for them and the seaport that Europe was building for them, if they simply lived in peace, none of this would have happened.
Yeah, but see, the thing about it is, all my life I've been watching us kill them. Okay, and now, they've elected Hamas, which, you know, I wouldn't have done it. But the moment they did, we cut them off.
It was a minority. A plurality of a minority.
We cut them off. We've condemned them. They're living in squalor because of us. Okay?
Well, they're living in squalor. I think it goes back to my early history. I mean, because of what Egypt did, because of what Israel did, because of the whole history of the region, it is getting worse. Hamas has definitely made it much worse for them.
No, but how about this? Cutting off food, cutting off water. When they try to tunnel to Egypt to get supplies, it's like, oh my goodness, they might get guns. Cut off those tunnels.
But they're not cutting off food and water. They are cutting off the tunnels.
Okay, why are they starving?
There were 100 truckloads of food that came in just last week from Israel.
Well, but it's not enough. And they are clamped down upon. Sure, they have enough of subsistence, but it's a horrible, horrible existence.
It is a horrible existence, but when will they see they are the architects of their own destruction? I do feel for the civilians very much. I think the only way that there's an out, and I want to take the last 5 minutes to close and make my point, so I'm going to do that. But I want to thank you for your call. I really do.
Okay.
I just want to close by saying that there is no easy answer here. There is no easy out here. But I think the only possible out is to separate the civilians, if at all possible, from Hamas. And how do you do that? Well, Egypt once occupied the land. They occupied it from 1949 to 1967. They had no more right to be there than Israel has a right to be there. But during that time, there were some attacks, but they were from the Egyptian government. They weren't from the people of Gaza into Israel. Egypt is a brutal dictatorship. We fund that dictatorship. We give that dictatorship some $2 billion a year. After Israel, it is the largest recipient of foreign aid. Egypt, I think, could crack down and would want to crack down in ways that Israel never could. You see, when Arabs kill Arabs, sad to say, the world rarely complains. When Hamas murdered 616 civilians and members of Fatah, there was a few news stories, but not that many. Egypt knows how to rule over Islamic militants. There are Islamic militants that want to overthrow the government of Egypt, and it manages to tamp them down. It is a dictatorship. I don't know what the answer is for the people of Gaza, but I would think that even living under an Egyptian dictatorship would be better than the current problem. I look at the Iraqis living under Saddam Hussein's brutal rule, and while he certainly was a dictator and he opposed anyone who would try to overthrow him, they had electricity, they had schools, they had shops that worked. They didn't have missiles raining down on them all the time. Perhaps that is the only possibility for Gaza. In the West Bank, I think that with the peaceful rule of Abbas, maybe we can finally have a Palestinian state there. But Gaza, I think Egypt may be the only solution. It's not a pretty one, and I've been looking for any answer. The only other solution would be Israeli occupation, and the world certainly doesn't want that. Now, how do we convince Egypt to do that? Well, as I said, they are getting a lot of U.S. aid. As Jeff points out, they get a lot of our missiles. Indeed, some of the missiles that Hamas has been tunneling underground, made in the USA, may well be from Egypt. Sounds like they probably are. But I think if Egypt were to step up to the plate, and take an extra little piece of territory. Gaza has been ruled by Egypt in the past, and it's perhaps the only answer. Sadly, someone has to occupy Gaza. If not Israel, it has to be Egypt. When Gaza is alone, the people of Gaza can't control Hamas. Even when they have Fatah there, even when they have a rival government, it is forced out. Those people are shot at or killed or placed in jail. There are no easy answers there, and I don't claim there are. But I do ask that people ask yourself, what is best for the civilians of Gaza? What is best for them? Egyptian rule, Israeli rule, Hamas rule, what is best for them? Would they vote for Hamas if they had an election today? I don't think they would. Let's have another election. But what do we do if they vote for Fatah and Hamas still takes over and still uses them as a staging ground to kill and to try to invade Israel? To me, it's reminding of the same problem with the Taliban. I don't think the Afghanis, the majority of them, wanted the Taliban. A substantial minority did. But it was used as a staging ground, as a terrorist country. It was used to attack the United States, and that's why we went into Afghanistan. Israel has the same right of self-defense the United States does. Israel has the same obligation the United States does to avoid as many civilian casualties as possible. But at the end of the day, unless and until the Palestinians of Gaza can demonstrate that they can be at peace, someone has to take over. And I would prefer, frankly, it'd be Egypt rather than Israel. I know that's not a great answer. There are no great answers. But unless and until there is peace in Gaza, I think it's unlikely there will be peace in the West Bank. It's very hard to ask Israel to give up the West Bank when they've seen that when they unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, there were still missiles sent. Again, I wish I had an easier answer for you. I don't. If you want to comment on my website, feel free to do so at RadioInsideScoop.com. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the Senate and all the various intricacies of what's going on in Illinois and in Delaware, Colorado, Minnesota. We're going to get to that. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.